Hiya, Tim here with a message before the podcast. Due to rights reasons, the songs have been shortened for this podcast. Every song is taken from ABC's The Lexicon of Love. All tracks are written by Martin Fry, Mark White, Stephen Singleton, and David Palmer, except where additional writers are noted. Poison Arrow and The Look of Love Part 1 and 4 are also written by Mark Lickley. Tears Are Not Enough was also written by David Robinson and Mark Lickley. Forever Together was also written by Anne Dudley. The Lexicon of Love was released on 21st of June 1982 on Neutron. Now, enjoy the podcast.
Tim's listening party was a lockdown sensation.
Unfortunately, it was on Twitter, which you can't listen to.
But Absolute Radio has the solution.
Tim Burgess explores seminal albums alongside the artists who brought them to life.
Absolute Radio presents Tim's Listening Party with Tim Burgess.
Hiya, and welcome to another episode of Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio with me, Tim Burgess, where I sit down with an artist to play back a classic album together. We've had so many listening parties over the past year, covering classic albums with everyone from Texas to Simple Minds to New Order. Search for Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll have a whole archive of podcasts to catch up on. Make sure you get involved on Twitter throughout the show by tweeting at Tim_Burgess and at Absolute Radio using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party. This episode, I'm joined by one of the stars of the 1980s, Martin Fry. With a career spanning over four decades, since the release of his band's ABC's dazzling debut in 1982, he continues to sell out concert halls up and down the country. The Lexicon of Love is an incredible debut album. It's dazzling with its Trevor Horn production, it's hugely ambitious and almost cinematic in its scope and sound. It's an album that went to number one, achieving platinum in the UK, and it remains a captivating listen to this day, 42 years on. So you've just finished the tour then?
Yeah, I finished 21 dates. It started off as 10 and then it grew in size. So we finished about a week ago, yeah, at the Palladium. The Palladium three nights.
Wow. So it's gorgeous. I mean, a great place to see ABC.
Yeah, I think the setting's important.
Yeah.
I always did. But for the Lexicon of Love, the ideal setting is the red velvet curtains and the...
Yeah.
the stucco, rococo decor. Somewhere nice to park. I mean, 40 years on, my audience likes to park somewhere where the car doesn't get broken into. So, yeah, those are the three factors.
That's amazing. Maybe they always did, like somewhere nice to park, you know, even when they were teenagers, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
What were you thinking about when you were making Lexicon of Love?
The Lexicon of Love, we started recording, I guess, in late 81, yeah. What I was thinking was pure desperation. I had one shot.
Right.
I was living in Sheffield and either you became a professional footballer or a hairdresser. And I was neither, good at neither. And I knew that we had our one shot. And I do joke a bit from the stage now, but in Sheffield, like a lot of cities, you'd walk into a bar and there were bands everywhere. There were daydreamers walking down every single street of Sheffield in that time frame.
Yeah.
As there is today.
Yeah.
And, you know, Def Leppard would be playing cribbage in one corner.
Yeah.
And I kind of say... Phil Oakey was playing dominoes over there, you know, eating pork scratchings. I kind of say Jarvis Cocker was washing up glasses, but, you know, that's just to enhance my story.
Yeah.
But the reality was we had Clock DVA, Cabaret Voltaire, Salon Graff, Artery, the Stunt Kites, ABC were in there, The Human League, Def Leppard. There were all these bands, so I kind of figured we had to stand out from the crowd, so we went in the opposite direction to the prevailing mood in Sheffield, which was very postmodern.
Yeah, Cabaret Voltaire were kind of like, you know, very industrial, weren't they?
Yeah, industrial. The northern industrial soundscape was there.
So ABC were completely the opposite of that, weren't they?
Initially, we were writing songs like Poison Arrow and a song called Surrender, Do As I Say, which didn't make the album.
Yeah.
But they were kind of funky tracks. We were trying to really kind of ignite the dance floor, which was a kind of radical idea at the time, basically, way back then. So we'd be out listening to Earth, Wind & Fire and Chic in the clubs and coming home and listening to Joy Division and The Cure, early magazine, I suppose, Buzzcocks. So it was kind of trying to fuse those two fantastic worlds of music that you could dance to alongside the kind of new wave of music which was coming through. Does that make sense?
It does, and it's making more sense to me about Sheffield as a place, because I'm thinking Def Leppard making Hysteria. It's not like your usual kind of rock band album, and Human League making Dare, and you know, you making Lexicon of Love. They're very brave, you know, masterpieces, really, aren't they?
I think in a way, when you're in Sheffield, it wasn't even on the gig map. You know, in Manchester or Leeds, even Nottingham, bands had come through. But back then, the only band that ever did show up was Kraftwerk, and it had a profound effect. You know,
right,
they played Sheffield University.
Right.
And I remember looking around that audience, and I knew pretty much everybody from bands I'd seen.
Yeah.
So in a way, when you talk about Dare, it's kind of the ultra electronic album, isn't it? And Hysteria, in its own way, with Mutt Lange's production,
yeah,
it's kind of a fusion as well of hard rock.
They were very
rock.
Brave, weren't they? Brave records,
yeah.
I think.
So with the Lexicon of Love, we were following in those footsteps, yeah.
Ambitious.
We were ambitious. We had a hit. Our first record came out and it got to number 19 on the charts. It was called Tears Not Enough. But then we approached Trevor Horn because we wanted to get a producer that could make us shiny and gold and enhance what we were doing. We wanted to be as Vegas as possible, which was a very kind of radical idea back then.
Very, yeah. I mean, so, I guess that shows up in the artwork a little bit. I mean, I'm trying to piece together the artwork, and I was thinking there's a bit of James Bond in there.
Totally.
And there's, you know, there's like bits
cinema.
Of Vegas. Cinema, yeah.
And
I mean, it really resonated with people. I remember it, you know, when it all came out.
Nice.
And five singles, maybe, or maybe six singles off the album. I was trying to figure out whether it was a Trevor Horn production before checking it out, you know.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really reveal itself as a Trevor Horn production and with the trademarks, you know, that you would come to think of as a Trevor Horn production. But it's
It was the first album he ever produced, I think, outside of his own work with Buggles and stuff.
I was thinking of, like, The Fairlight and all that kind of stuff, and the synth bass, I guess, reveals itself towards the end, I think, on perhaps maybe Date Stamp or something, where it's kind of a familiar...
We had a sample of a till.
Yeah.
So it felt right. It was a sort of premonition of an omen to try and sell records. You know, it went ka-ching. So we used that overly.
But we
did use Fairlight 1 quite a lot. Prior to ABC, we were in a band called Vice Versa, which was all synthesizers. So we were used to kind of two-track and four-track recording and little monophonic synths. We used to build synths from oscillators and stuff to hit. And it was kind of the early days. So when it came to working, say, with Trevor, there was a band that was playing Sheffield Art College and travelling around the country in a van, but then we wanted to kind of make it as funky and as also as in time as possible. So we'd use the Fairlight as a sort of click track, basically, back then. Which back then was quite a novel idea. You know, we're talking over 40 years ago. That's why today the record's got a sheen and it kind of a contemporary feel, even though it's a very old record.
You can't really place it. I mean, it sounds modern. And I'm thinking, like, Trevor Horn. So he was in the Buggles.
Yeah, he did Dollar. I heard a record called Handheld in Black and White on the radio.
I remember Dollar. They were, like, frequent on Top of the Pops.
But it was kind of this panoramic sounding record. It was just... Yeah. It's great back in the day when you hear something on the radio, it would just blow your mind. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And take you down a totally different path. I remember hearing Rockbox by Run DMC in New York once when I first went to New York.
Yeah.
And I thought I was listening to two radio stations because there's the rappers and there's Eddie Martinez's hard rock guitar on the same record. This is Run DMC.
Oh.
I love those moments. It's like when Acid House kind of came in. You just heard a couple of those records and you thought, the world has changed forever.
Yeah.
The whole musical soundscape has changed. Of course, it doesn't change. And I go back to the classics, but I love those moments. So, yeah, I think that happened with the electronic music.
It's good to listen to the classics after you've heard all that stuff, isn't it? Because you can then sort of like go back and then go forward again. It's a wonderful thing. Let's kick off this listening party with the first track from Lexicon of Love. This is ABC with Showman. Show Me by ABC, the opening track from their 1982 debut album, The Lexicon of Love. So, let's talk about that opening track. Can you tell me a bit about that?
We knew the opening track to our album had to be something special, just to kind of attract attention. So that's why at the beginning of Show Me, there's a string arrangement. It's like a kind of fanfare to say, as the curtains open, the red velvet curtains open on the theatrical stage we present him, and then we go blam. There's some fretless bass guitar on that track, which Brad Lang played. We kind of parted company with our bass player midway through the recording sessions. There was a guy called Mark Lickley playing on the album, and then Brad Lang took over. But he was an incredible fretless bass player, and it was Well, I guess it was around about the time of Mick Kahn in Japan.
Yeah.
Fretless is less kind of used today, but it was kind of a very novel sound back then.
Fretless bass, when it sounds right, there's nothing better.
I guess you can play pretty loose on it, but...
Yeah.
So Show Me was our call to arms, definitely. We didn't mind that there was a Dexys Midnight Runners song called Show Me too, because I was a big Dexys fan.
Yeah.
But ours is slightly different, yeah. Ours is a cry for love, I think.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I was going to say, what was your lexicon of love?
Well, the lexicon of love is a combination of love songs, but it's about a lot of different people, no one person, really.
So, I mean...
You do think it's about one person, like, it's a concept album, but yeah. No. Yeah. I think one of the reasons why it's kind of been durable and lasted through the years is a lot of people have had a broken heart, you know what I mean? So... people do identify with some of those songs.
But I'm just wondering about how old you were when it was written. But it's like, you know, everyone has a broken heart on, don't they? You know,
teenage years. Yeah, definitely. I mean, by the time the Lexicon of Love was being made, I was about 22, I suppose, 21, 22. So I'd lived a long life, by the time. Yeah. That's how it felt then.
Yeah.
It's intense. And when you're young... there's a real intensity to any sort of relationship when it kind of falls apart. And, you know, that's definitely in there on the record.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Also, I kind of felt I didn't want to write songs about sort of electric pylons, or there was a whole kind of school of postmodernist English pop, which was very unemotional.
Yeah.
I really used to love listening to Sinatra and all those kind of great records, Motown as well.
What's your favourite Sinatra?
The Best Is Yet to Come is a fantastic song. Wow. All those great, I'm talking about those Cole Porter songs.
And, wow.
The thing with Sinatra was, he was a vortex to every songwriter, wasn't he? He kind of like took the best songs from every generation and sang them. I just kind of like that lyricism and that kind of suave kind of quality that you get in a lot of those songs.
Yeah.
I still aspire to that.
You brought it to 1982?
Tried to.
Let's move on to the second track, and before we talk about it, let's play that classic, Poison Arrow. So, Poison Arrow, I mean, anyone who's listened to music over the past 40 years will have heard the song.
Poison Arrow was our second single, and it was a big hit.
Yeah.
So a lot changed for us then. And you know this, Tim, because you've been in many a successful band. The world changes, but you don't really realise it. You're at the kind of centre of a storm.
Mm.
Your relationship with the band changes as well, you know, if you're a lead singer. I don't have lead singer-itis, but I am an elder
many
statesman
do, many
of pop
do, though.
Now, yeah. But Poison Arrow came along and everything with it, Top of the Pops, acclaim. There's a bit in the middle where I go, I thought you loved me, but it seems you didn't care. And it was a Friday evening and the receptionist in Psalm East was called Karen, Karen Clayton. And I got her just before she got on the tube to come into the microphone and she says, I care enough to know I can never love you. I thought you loved me, but it seems you don't care.
I care enough to know I can never love you.
So she's immortalised there forever.
Wow.
I love those kind of chance accidents. We had a manifesto that said we weren't going to have a guitar solo in the middle eight, so we had to kind of think of things that would happen in the middle of our records.
Yeah,
so
it's a good manifesto to have.
That came around at the time.
Yeah.
Less of a manifesto now, but I love
It's good to have them at the time, isn't it? It's sort of like encourage you to sort of think... I'm going to say outside the box, but I don't usually use that phrase. Yeah, but
it's allowed to. Yeah. I was thinking about the Ramones recently and how the best bands have to have the same haircut, they have to eat the same food. If they can all come from the same street, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
But you have to have that single, joking aside, you have to have that single laser-like vision to kind of stand any chance of succeeding.
It's
the stuff you leave out, isn't it? So it was definitely like that with ABC. Yeah, we were all kind of focused into trying to make something that was kind of original and was our voice, you know, our sound.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, no one sounded like ABC.
I guess, hopefully. Yeah. Not, but maybe. It's nice when you're successful and you hear bands that do sound a bit like you. That's a kind of sound of applause.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's nice.
So Poison Arrow was your first hit.
Well, Poison Arrow, it's a love song, but it's a hate song too. And if you love somebody, you end up hating them at some point.
Yeah,
in small doses.
You mentioned Cupid, you know. I mean,
Who Broke My Heart?
Yeah, you did. Cupid.
Bow to the Target.
Stupid. Did he say stupid at one point?
Yeah, if I can rhyme three lines, I'm Smokey Robinson.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, Smokey would come up in a conversation with you, right?
Yeah. I mean, my record collection back then was just full of stuff, really. I was out clubbing a lot. But you'd hear things like TVOD or Warm Leather Rare, early sort of Cabaret Voltaire in the clubs, but then come home and listen to Songs for Swinging Lovers and stuff like that.
Yeah. For me, when I was going out...
Motown stuff.
...to clubs and listening to Acid House and stuff.
Yeah.
And then people would... would go home to people's houses or flats or whatever, and you'd listen to The Birds or Axis Bold of Love Electric Prunes or something like that. So it'd all be, everything would be kind of psychedelic. So
for obvious reasons. Well, Danny Rampling would sometimes mix stuff at Shoom, kind of Chicago house and Detroit techno stuff with Lennon and stuff like that. You'd hear songs. It was fantastic in those Balearic. Well, that was the sort of principle of Balearic too, wasn't it? Mixing up sounds, but anyway.
I mean, you've always kept up to date, haven't you, with everything?
I like that moment when you hear something brand new and it hits you.
Yeah.
I do like that. Not to emulate it, you know, not to chase it, but to kind of feel it.
No, yeah, I mean, it's rarer these days
for
me. Maybe it's part... Because I've had a beard for, you know, about 6 weeks now. And,
okay.
And, I was in the bath and MGMT came on and I just decided, no, today's the day I'm going to shave my beard off and just sort of, like, get back in the world again, you know.
Yeah,
it's been a long winter and a nice, like, in bulk.
Yeah, that's essential.
It is.
Writing and evolving.
Yeah, I think so too. And, you know, I feel like, you know, I've got a spring in my step and...
Yeah.
Ready for action now.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to make another record? I'm making another record. It's a tough one,
isn't it? Can't stop.
Yeah.
I try to.
I'm always writing stuff. Yeah.
I try to sometimes. And then when you try to stop, it all pours out. When you try to eclipse what you've done before, that's when you kind of like...
Oh, that's impossible. Yeah. No, it's just purely for the pleasure of the moment.
The great thing and the worst thing about myself is that I forget how to do it every time.
Yeah, but that's the great thing. Yeah, that is the great thing.
Yeah. I think it is too. But it's also like, you know, very frustrating. But I think it allows for originality, I think.
Yeah, but that means that you're going to keep writing. New stuff.
Oh, that's good.
Bringing new stuff into the world.
Yeah, thanks, Martin.
It's the same conversation that goes around in Mother's
Eye. Yeah. Time for another song. Here's track number 3 on the album, Many Happy Returns. When she's gone, all I've got to learn is the law of diminishing return. When she's here, one thing I've found, things get better second time around. Return, many happy returns. These are the lessons I could have learned. Return, many happy returns. And these are the letters I should have burned. I'm sad. So, many happy returns. I think this is a masterpiece.
Oh, very kind of you to say
yes.
that.
Yes, I mean, for me, this is where the album really, really begins, because from Many Happy Returns to Forever Together, it's just they're outdoing each other on the epic sort of like front, I think. Epic front? I don't know whether that's the right way, but you know...
Well, we want to sound as larger than life as possible.
Yeah.
On Many Happy Returns... I think we'd had a hit record with Poison Arrow, so your confidence grows.
Yeah.
But I wanted to do the Raymond Chandler.
So were you writing as you were going?
There was about a core of about 10 or 12 songs we were working with. But we ditched a few of them as we recorded
stuff. Okay, yeah.
Which is normal, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So with Many Happy Returns, it was kind of pre-written. There's a Philip Marlowe sort of Raymond Chandler opening where I get to sort of speak. When I accepted this job, I was resigned to my fate.
Yeah.
When I got there early. So I would find any opportunity just to talk, to avoid singing on the record.
Wow,
I liked singing.
Wow.
And also I remember with the arrangement, on the last third of it, Trevor edited it. And he opened it up. So then Anne played this beautiful electric piano solo on the way out.
Yeah.
And for us to be able to kind of expand it, because we were working off a template off of Fairlight One, like programming a beatbox, really, pre-beatbox. So it kind of opened it up a bit.
Yeah.
And it made it more expansive and luxuriant. So that's what Many Happy Returns suggests for me. The other thing was it had such a bland title. It's the kind of thing you get in a birthday card, you know.
And well, I wanted to make it... There's a few like that, though, isn't there?
I wanted to play with that, to try and do something that was kind of fairly complex and fraught with a really bland exterior, you know. I don't know why that is. I've always liked that. It's always a bit pretentious when people come along and say, I've written this complex, beautiful song. You know, and I don't know, some artists are like that. I'm not. Let the people decide.
You know? I like the idea that, you know, you've got these like amazing arrangements and very lush and very epic.
Yeah.
And you're talking about a job. And you know, you're talking...
And a relationship.
And a relationship.
Really.
And yeah, accepting a job offer. It's kind of like quite a sort of plain...
Prosaic.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, obviously this was very early 80s, but I guess for me it was like the groundwork for sort of like escapism, I suppose. I mean,
Absolutely.
It was classic escapism with the sound and the lyrics... With that soundscape.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up kind of going to see all the punk bands early on, you know. But I realised there was a whole generation of punk bands coming through that weren't particularly authentic. They were just pretending to be. So for me, I was happy to put on a gold suit or the tuxedo, mainly because most of the guys in Sheffield would go to jumble sales to get their clothes, you know, it's pre-vintage. You were kind of buying tweed suits and waistcoats and long overcoats, you know, that was postmodern England at the time.
Yeah.
So I was never daunted by pretending I was kind of like street or authentic. I was.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I spent most of my time on the street.
In Hyde
Park Flats in Sheffield or signing on the dole. So there's a very gritty reality to Sheffield and I was there living it.
Yeah.
But we'd see people clubbing on a Wednesday at Penny's. The best clubs were always midweek. They were the hippest clubs.
Yeah.
And I'd see guys getting on trains. They'd make their own zoot suits and show up at Penny's Disco on a Wednesday night, getting the train from Rotherham and Doncaster and surrounding areas.
Amazing.
And it was kind of one of the most stylish clubs I've ever been to. I've been to a lot of clubs back in my time. And I kind of wonder about this. I felt a part of that audience. So that's why... With the Lexicon of Love, it's a very kind of shiny... It's not really a yuppie sort of cocktail bar version of the 1980s, but it's a very aspirational record.
Yeah.
And it had to be, because life was really tough back then in those northern towns.
Yeah.
I don't really like saying it now because it sounds like a cliche, but it was tough.
Yeah.
And there was a whole generation coming through. You call it peacock culture or new romantics or whatever. Two Tone was there with Jerry Dammers and the Specials and all that. But there was a whole generation that really wanted to shout out loud because we knew we were invisible.
Yeah.
You know, there was nobody in power in government looking out for my generation.
Yeah.
Unemployment was very high. The options were slim. And you felt that everywhere you went in Sheffield. You felt it in Manchester too.
Yeah.
So that's why you've got like these larger-than-life characters like Annie Lennox and Boy George and Simon Le Bon and Phil Oakey.
Yeah.
Very distinctive people.
Yeah,
coming through, just as ABC were. So Depeche Mode, The Cure, point to anyone, and they were very extreme looks. The kind of looks that would turn heads in pubs, you know what I mean? And that's the reality of where the Lexicon of Love came from, yeah.
Does that make sense? I don't know. I was a fan of all of it, you know?
Yeah.
It was just great to see.
You see, great rock and roll comes from the days when you go into a pub and a guy won't let you sit down or, you know, they want to throw you out of the pub simply because you're wearing something they object to.
Yeah.
And I kind of think about that now and I think, well, 40 years later, here I am on stage in the spotlight. I've survived. I've lived to tell the tale.
Okay, let's play track number 4 on the album. This is Tears Are Not Enough on Absolute Radio. Track 4 from The Lexicon of Love, Tears Are Not Enough.
The Lexicon of Love, it kind of has a swagger to it, which we had to have a swagger. What were the alternatives, you know? we were constantly trying to be at the cutting edge of everything, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think whilst that's complete folly and it can lead to disaster, it's a great way of looking at making a record.
So Trevor Horn came in after this track, Tears Not Enough, or was he involved in the album version?
Yeah, Trevor we met at the bottom of Queensway in a pizza parlour. Yeah. And we'd met a couple of producers, Alex Sackin, who did the Grace Jones records, and then we loved the Dollar records, so we met Trevor. And I could tell immediately Trevor got it. He had a great sense of humour. And a spokesman for the band, I was like... I mean, I speak fast now, and I'm in my 60s, I'm mellow. I was like on fire back then, walking around town telling everybody about the future of rock and roll and how ABC would be a part of it. But I could tell Trevor instantly kind of appreciated the approach, the attitude, I guess. Yeah. So we set off recording Poison Arrow. But when it came to do Tears Not Enough, he ironed out a few of the kinks on the original record. We put on a harpsichord solo in the middle eight, Louis XIV, We added that, And maybe we tightened up some of the hand claps and stuff like that. Yeah.
So was this, all these studios in London, Psalm East and Townhouse and Rack?
Yeah, Psalm East, on Brick Lane.
Yeah.
That's where we spent a lot of time.
Did he have something, some kind of ownership of that?
Jill Sinclair, Trevor's wife and manager, her brother was involved.
Oh, wow.
And he was producing Foreigner and stuff like that, bands like that.
Wow. I've recorded at Psalm West, I think.
Well, Psalm West came about when Island Records, the success of the album and Trevor's success, Island Records said you can have Psalm West, which was where Roxy and Bob Marley and, I don't know, everybody on Island recorded, probably you two too. But Psalm East was a tiny, tiny studio, single studio underneath the wig shop on Brick Lane. Yeah.
Nice.
The beautiful thing about it was, they told me they did Bohemian Rhapsody in there, so they must have recorded some of it there. But it was kind of like a funky part of town back then. Brick Lane's a kind of approachable neighbourhood now. But back then you took your life into your hands. We used to go to
the bagel shop still there?
Yeah, the bagel shop is there.
That's right.
The tube station.
That's right.
Stunning. You used to spend a bit of time in there. And at night we'd go to Ichiku Park, which was just around the corner, obviously. Uh-huh. Written about in the Small Faces too. But the great thing was, there was like one Asteroids machine and nothing else to do. So we'd sit behind that desk and focus, you know what I mean, on the record, you know. It was like, I think we got a lot done there because there was nothing else to do. There was no...
It's great when you meet somebody.
So there was
Gary
Langan engineering, Trevor Horn producing, and Dudley came in, Mark White, Steve Singleton, myself, Dave Palmer on drums. We got our new drummer on.
So
who plays with Rod Stewart now. David still
did
plays
he play with the as well?
Yeah, he played with Matt Johnson.
Yeah.
Also,
I love Matt.
Electronic.
Oh, that's right.
Johnny,
that's right,
Mar and,
with Johnny,
Bernard.
Yeah.
So David has been playing with Rod Stewart now. David's a guy, right? I went to a working man's club in 1981 and there's this kid playing drums and you could just tell he was brilliant. I think he was a couple of years younger than me. And I think he'd been playing with in a band called John O'Hara's Playboys in the working men's clubs every night, you know, since he was about 10. You know, he was just a world-class drummer, you know, in Rotherham.
Yeah.
So he joined the band. But these days he plays with Rod Stewart and has played with, he's been in Rod's band for many years. So there you go.
We just bigger working men's clubs.
Yeah, right. The world is a working man's club.
Let's get on another song from your 1982 debut, track number 5, Valentine's Day. That was Valentine's Day by ABC. To mention this day on your album, Valentine's Day, you know, about love. And
because it has quite a romantic title, I figured I could pour as much angst in as possible. So it had no chorus. And it eventually showed up in a whiskey. It became a single in Japan on a whiskey advert and was a success there.
Wow.
So I think that's the sign of success when you make it in
Tokyo.
Reminds
me of Lost in Translation.
So there's a lot of Tokyo whiskey drinkers that know this song. But the song itself, the lyrics I kind of wrote in the studio, but they were from, they're all the bits in the book that I'd not used on other songs. So the venom was just flying out. So when the postman don't call on Valentine's Day, Santa Claus don't come on a Christmas Day. And it just kind of goes on. It just kind of rants to a peak. With all our songs, we wanted everything to peak. We didn't want to fade out on any of the records. We wanted everything to be like a sort of mini pop opera. It all kind of pushed to a final climax. That was the kind of, and you'll see that a lot on the record.
And Dudley was doing the arrangements.
Yeah. We wondered what to do about strings. We were talking a lot about Philadelphia.
Philadelphia soul,
Soul and Motown, Atlantic and Stax. And on all those records, there are brilliant string arrangements. Northern soul as well. A lot of the songs that are popular in Northern soul clubs. So Trevor said, you know something, we should really put some strings on a couple of these songs. And I'm thinking, well, can we get away with it? You know, will we be bland? You know, will it be left field enough? You know, but he kind of persevered with the idea. So I said, how are we going to do it then? And I raised a hand and said, I'll have a go. I'm going to go home tonight and I'll come back tomorrow with some charts.
Yeah.
And in she walked the next day, worked it out on the piano.
And Anne was already in Art of Noise.
Anne was a really great classically trained pianist. So she came in and did some solos and things. And had worked with Trevor on, I think, Dollar. Art of Noise was formed after the recording, when Trevor formed ZTT Records, and then he was looking for acts to go on his label. So he created one with Anne, with Gary Langan, his in-house team.
Fantastic.
Basically.
Wow. And you still play with Anne now?
Yeah, it's great to kind of tour the country with Anne conducting.
Yeah.
So she's a remarkable musician, really remarkable. So a lot happened in that little room in Psalm East. Yeah, a lot evolved, changed. So we'd had a hit record, so we were able to go and record some strings, I think, in Abbey Road, in one of the smaller rooms there,
Because I suppose, like, on your debut album, having strings, it's quite brave, you know. I mean, but then, you know, the whole album was brave, so
we'd spend a fortune, though, after the first opportunity, because we did an amalgamation of every single track on the album. And we put it on the B-side of a single called All In My Heart. So the record company wanted that on the album, but we never bothered putting it on there. So I wouldn't do that now, but we had some pretty elaborate B-sides. That was important back in the day. Totally.
Sounds good, the whole package.
But yeah, there are some strings on there. I've recently done an orchestral tour with full orchestra, the South Bank Symphony, with Anne conducting and the band. But there aren't as much strings as you think there are. The Selena string machines, not even samples, really. Just, we cheat it. Basically with synthesizers, but there are some real strings.
I like using Selena.
Is Selena still in town?
It's
a wonderful string machine.
It really is. And you know, I mean, that and the
blending
ARP so, you know, do you like Valentine's Day?
Whenever I play it now in 2024, I kind of wipe my brow at the end of it, because there's a lot of words. And I say to the audience, if only I'd known then what I know now.
Yeah.
66-year-old man standing on a stage before them in my tuxedo with my orchestra.
Amazing.
I would have kind of preferred a back catalogue like Too Unlimited, you know, with less words. What's that? There's no limit. Simpler lyrics.
Oh, yeah.
But
just
Valentine's Day, I mean, I have to say, I love Bob Dylan too, you know. I used to kind of aspire. I used to wonder how he wrote kind of 8 or 9 verses to a song, you know. Yeah. So there was an element of that with Valentine's Day.
Charlatans decided that we'd do an album with no choruses. You know, I mean, based on Bob Dylan's, you know, multi-verse.
Yeah.
You know.
Thing. Yeah.
It did pretty good, you know.
Did you repeat any lines?
No,
No,
I just really went for it, you know.
That's a great principle. Hard, though.
It's hard.
Exhausting.
I listen to a lot of Bob Dylan records for references.
I know you do, in fact.
Yeah, so you mentioned Fred Astaire and, you know, a nice mention of a Minx doll, I think, is that?
Yeah, School for Scandal, Guess Who's in a Role. I kind of name-checked anything that was on my mind. Yeah. It's kind of pre-rapping sort of approach.
That's good to know.
School for Scandal. Your heart's on parade, your heart's on parole. I hope you find a sucker to buy that Minx doll.
Yeah, that's
School
it. Yeah.
Scandal, guess who's enrolled?
Yeah,
the triple rhyme you see.
Yeah, it's amazing. I love it.
It served me well. It's carried me down many a bar, but it's carried me through many a session a studio. I'd find words and try and slip them in there somewhere. Yeah. That's the core of most songwriting for me, really. Yeah, getting away with it.
I like that.
Yeah.
So, Martin, tell me more about the context of ABC's first album.
It was a very ambitious record from a very ambitious band.
It's very impressive, you know.
We were signing on the Dole on West Street, and we knew we didn't want to do that forever, yeah. You know, but the options weren't great. So we threw our heart and soul into the record, yeah.
It was great to re-listen to it. I listened to it in the bath. And you're not allowed to say that? No, okay. I'm allowed to say...
Do you think music sounds better in the bathroom?
I've always had a really great relationship with the bath and music. Yeah. And I don't know whether it was through watching Quadrophenia or something like that. I don't know what it was. But basically, when I was a kid, you know, we lived in a two up, two down.
Yeah.
And my room was next to the bathroom. Door open, blasting the record, door open in the bathroom, you know.
I'll tell you what, Tim, the acoustics is always great in a bathroom.
Yeah.
It's tiled.
Yeah, Joe Meek.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. You got some natural ambience there as well.
It was a natural ambience. Joe Meek sort of like had it as a reverb room, didn't he, you know?
Yeah.
The bathroom.
In a way, Joe Meek must have kind of created a sound, didn't he, that everybody has followed.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's the sound that was born on Holloway Road, or in Holloway, for sure.
Yeah.
I do want to know, like, what the mood was like in Sheffield. I had a story, right, about you, Martin Fry.
Some are true and some aren't.
Yeah, of course.
It goes with mythology.
I'm sure I heard it at school, right? Oh. But I heard that you lived in Stretford.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was born in Stretford.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Because because when I walked through Stretford, I was thinking, oh, this is amazing. Unless it's completely untrue, Martin Fry lives in Stretford, and Morrissey was born in Stretford. So it's like,
yeah,
what
probably,
a great place Stretford is. And, you know, I opened a building society account. So.
Albert Finney Bookies, yeah, used to be nearby.
Wow, so there you go. So it's a true story.
I was born in the same hospital as Morrissey, yeah. But I was born there, but then I hitchhiked over the Pennines to a place called Sheffield. I didn't really know where Sheffield was.
Wow. So what age was this?
To university.
Okay.
And it's there I kind of was studying English literature, and then the band... I was working at Bachelor's Bean Factory, to cut a long story short, and that's where the band evolved. I met a couple of guys. Sheffield was a hotbed, but I would always be travelling back to Rafters and the Electric Circus. And all those seminal bands with my mate Mike Pickering. We were schoolmates, so...
Wow.
I'd be going back to Rafters and the Electric Circus to see everybody from the Buzzcocks, Susie and the Banshees, to the Joy Division.
Wow.
The Anarchy Tour, all that stuff. So I had my musical education in Manchester, yeah, definitely.
So you saw the Sex Pistols at Rafters?
I saw the at the Lesser Free Trade Hall.
Oh, wow.
The second gig
The second one there,
the Buzzcocks opening up.
So who played...
And I saw them at the Electric Circus. They played twice because the Anarchy Tour...
Yeah?
It just folded. Because it got banned from everywhere, so it was fantastic.
Oh, my God.
They came back about 10 days later to Manchester and saw them there, yeah.
They love Manchester, though, don't they? Oh, John Lydon.
The shows were fantastic. Oh, yeah, and Public Image did one of the first shows at Bellevue, so I went to that too, yeah.
Wow.
So I'm painting the picture of my childhood, yeah.
Yeah, so Banshees and...
Wandering around those
Buzzcocks.
Streets. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. With Howard Devoto as the lead singer, Spiral Scratch.
Wow.
I mean, I was thinking about how many bands from Manchester survive every single... thing inflicted on them. When you look at the transition from Joy Division to New Order, for obvious reasons, with the death of Ian Curtis. But the Buzzcocks, man, at some point Pete Shelley must have said, okay, I'm going to be the singer.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? For that whole second period. It just means that music had to be made. It had to be made. There was no way there was any obstacle.
I agree.
Chart position, band dispute, nothing was going to stand in their way.
Let's play another song. Here's a classic from the album, The Look of Love. Track number 6, Look of Love, open bracket, part 1, close bracket.
Look of Love, part 4 is at the end of the album, and we did actually do some harsh New York City club-inspired remixes of for 2 and for 3. And there's an overture as well, with a full orchestral overture. So we did come back to the theme of The Look of Love. The Look of Love is a great ABC Hallmark song. It will follow me forever. And it's kind of one of those songs, I can play it in the set, then encore with it. You know, it's a great song to have in your repertoire.
Yeah.
But it's simply a song about when your world is full of strange arrangements, gravity won't pull you through, you know where
That's
I got that.
Beautiful.
It's that moment when your world is crushed and you're on the canvas and that feeling of defiance when you get up and you dust yourself down. That is the kind of abiding kind of core to that song, The Look of Love.
Yeah.
And again, with a title like The Look of Love, it's almost like a sort of fairly flippant Hallmark birthday card type of a title.
Yeah.
But the song has been able to resonate with a lot of people through the years because it's kind of about something they feel, I think.
Yeah.
When we made the record, a brilliant thing happened in that David Bowie came to the sessions. We were working over at Dean Street, Good Earth Studio, near here on Good Earth Studios, Tony Visconti Studio, because we got kicked out of Psalm East. We'd kind of work for 3 days, then go somewhere else just to kind of record. I went to the Record Mirror to kind of go and do an interview. And then Bowie showed up. He was doing Baal around the corner, the theatrical production.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he came to see Tony Visconti, his mate,
his
producer and good friend. And he sat in on the sessions. It was just mind-blowing to us because we're massive Bowie fans, you know.
So you're doing The Look of Love,
We're recording The Look of Love, and we're recording parts on that day for like 12-inch stuff. And I was talking to Anne Dudley recently, and she says that when she was playing the parts, Bowie was kind of hanging out with his cup of tea, and he'd go, try this. You know, a kind of counter-rhythm thing. I'd forgotten all about that. But, yeah, that was for real. So in a way, he came into the studio. I don't know if he'd heard of us, but he kind of was hanging out. Trevor's there, and the sessions were fun. Everything was fun making this record, I should say. You know, a lot happened in every day.
Yeah.
So he was hanging out. I guess he sparkled some of his magic dust on us, you know. We were just the fledgling band from Sheffield, you know, and he's David Bowie. So it was a great day in the studio.
Yeah, he has that power, right?
He does. I mean, he always had that inquisitive...
Curiosity,
yeah, didn't he? About what was going on with bands, every generation coming through. So it was great to feel that. So I kind of always think that, really. He blessed our recording, and that's why the record's been... It's probably our biggest record, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just... there's nothing you can really say about it. I mean, I just wrote such a big song, and that's...
Oh!
That's really downplaying it, I think. But,
The other thing was... again, no guitar solos. So I'd run out of ideas by then, and there was two middle eights. There were two middle eights in there. In one of them, I had to do this speech. I kind of, and it's followed me around for 40 years. You know, sometimes I get in a cab and a guy will go, "So Martin, did you find true love?" Because in it, I go, and I name check myself in the great spirit of James Brown or Iggy Pop. It was fairly audacious, really. But I go, "Hey Martin, maybe one day you'll find true love."
They say, "Martin, maybe one day you'll find true love." To the one thing.
We had this speech, and I remember Bowie said it would be great to have an answering machine message. He had this idea for the answering machine message, just his suggestions.
Yeah.
We never got around to doing that. So it was still a hit without using his idea, but it would have been a great thing to feature too.
I've named that myself twice in songs now. But you know, in my 50s, though.
Yeah, I like that, though.
So, you know, it took me a bit longer than it took
I mean,
you.
I sometimes forget my own name as well, you know, so I should do it more often. Yeah. It was a kind of real joy to, you know, maybe you should check with Gary Langan or Trevor Horn or Mark White or Steve Singleton, but it was a laugh making the record, and I think some of that shines through.
I mean,
it's hard work making records. It's kind of, the pressure's on.
It can be
but
really...
But there are times when it can be fantastic.
It can be really not fun. But and I was going to say when you mentioned it earlier that it's really rare to have fun times making a record, and to create fun in a studio is... not as easy as you would think. But on a first record, I suppose it's easier.
It's your definition of fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I know what it's like when it's not fun recording, you know, when the pressure's on and you feel like you I don't know, it's really hard. But when the momentum's there and everybody's focused and feeling it, because people don't always get that making a record is such a collaborative thing.
Yeah.
It is, you know, there's so many different factors to it.
Yeah.
I like it when it's firing on all sides.
I love it when you hear something that's inspiring. Really amazing, really inspiring, and that creates more inspiration. And you know, and then you put that back in, and then all of a sudden you've just got this like massive wall of sound. Yeah, exactly. Beyond your expectations, and then that feeling is just, it's extraordinary.
were lucky really to have had chances to go into recording studios at different points in my life, like you have.
Yeah.
And you can find that again, but in different... Yeah. You never can chase the same thing.
No, no, I mean... Spirit.
And we used to do demos that would... They'd be laborious, you know, or there'd be fights, you know, stuff like that. Yeah. Chairs would be thrown, you know.
Yeah.
It was never great, but I have to say, with Trevor, with Gary Langan, it was fantastic back then. Yeah, it was great. I don't know, maybe I'm looking through it at rose-tinted spectacles, but it was... We were devoted to trying to make a very original record, yeah. And that would happen every day. Every couple of hours, there'd be something happening on the record.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. Martin, let's move on to track 7, Date Stamp. But before we talk about it, let's give it a listen. Side 2 continues with Date Stamp, which I think is possibly my favourite.
Oh, thank you very much. I get to duet on this.
Yeah,
we had a sample of a cash register. Ka-ching. So we actually put it on the record. That's cheeky.
It's pretty cheeky.
As a sort of omen to possibly selling some records, which we hadn't done at the time. So that's on there. But that song is clearly about consumerism in a funny kind of way. I used to love the Gang of Four, so maybe there's some of that in there.
Yeah.
But it's a song lyrically about no one lasts forever. You know, everything has a price tag. Everything has a sell-by date. And that's kind of the idea of the song. And then it's about how a relationship, you know, if you love someone, will it have a sell-by date? You know, or will it last forever? You know, that's the kind of the brief in the song. I have to say, when we play it live now, I realise the bass part is a proto version of the bass part Trevor used on Relax.
That was the first time I thought, yeah,
Andy
this
guy. Our bass player, hits it, and I'm thinking, yeah.
That was the first time I thought to myself, yeah, it's produced by Trevor Horn.
So with the cash registers, with the bass part, yeah, the whole female vocals, male vocals. I've always loved Prince, but I love Sly and the Family Stone.
Yeah, me too.
Dance to the Music and Stand, he'd have four vocalists, or the Temptations.
Yeah.
So I was always looking for somebody else on The Look of Love. All I'm saying, it takes a lot to love you, all I'm doing. Only we didn't have any other singers, so I used to have to do all the parts and pretend there was somebody else.
Yeah.
But I was always looking for that kind of lovely spirit you get on, say, Dance to the Music, you know, where it's kind of different voices coming at you from different corners of the record. That happens on Dates now.
Have you ever seen that Bowie video when he's doing Young Americans and he's kind of rehearsing on the stage stuff like that? And I mean, that's a similar vibe as well, isn't it?
Never
amazing.
Never turning back. Never need no. His arrangements on Luther Vandross is stunning.
Yeah,
there,
of course.
It? Oh, it's just stunning. Yeah.
So it was all that.
Well, I wanted to do that, and of course it was influenced by Young Americans.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
It's a phenomenal album.
Yeah.
But on a shoestring. Yeah. So there were never any singers around. I'd get the guys in the band to do it for me.
It doesn't
me,
sound
yeah.
like it was on a shoestring, though, at all. I mean, what I love is, you know, there's lyrics about sales talk from sales assistants.
Yeah.
And you mention supply and demand, which I think is very good in a... But it's related to love as well, I suppose, you know.
I guess in one way, in the 80s, it was kind of a pre-yuppie coffee achiever cocktail bar version.
Yeah.
But people were obsessed with money. They were. It was kind of in the air. People didn't really know what 1984 was going to look like ahead of the a couple of years.
I was always worried about 1984.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a kind of a sort of fear in the air.
I was a kid then.
Why? Yeah. So I guess there's that too, yeah. Life isn't really a supermarket, but people thought it was.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
It does, it does.
And that's in that song, Dexter.
And in a funny way, I suppose that takes me to Jarvis Cocker. I think it was very influenced by that kind of, you know, what you were doing there, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Pulp, I love Pulp. But,
yeah, of course. Yeah, and I'm just wondering whether it's a Sheffield thing or whether it's just,
a Roxy Music thing.
Yeah.
We're both drinking from the same source of elixir, you know, Roxy Music.
I love Brian Ferry.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I always like lyrics where, you know, you got the unexpected happens. I think that's good.
What's your favourite Roxy album?
You know what? I was thinking long and hard about this recently. I had to do a sort of favourite album. I put Stranded.
Me too.
Because of Manzanera.
I mean,
Song for Europe, and the way Manzanera plays on the record.
Yeah.
It's just on fire.
Street Life.
Street Life.
And it's without Eno as well, which is kind of weird, but, you know, but it is the best Roxy album.
You know, I was talking earlier about where people don't put any obstacle in front of them. Brian Eno had just left the band.
Yeah.
And yet they came forward with a third album, Stranded.
Yeah, it's amazing. I love that record.
With Eddie Jobson in there. Yeah, it's incredible. Songwriting's incredible.
Amazing, amazing.
I was in a hotel 2 days ago. Phone rang. I went over to it and there was nobody there. And I just thought of the lyrics straight away. What's that line? When I pick it up, there's no one there. So I walk outside. I think I started singing it to my wife, but she just didn't know what I was referring to, really. She likes music. She
but
likes
now you're telling her world, but she's fantastic.
Yeah.
I love that.
What is that? Is that the brain? Why would you remember a record from like 45 years ago? Oh, well.
All of My Heart.
Yeah, All of My Heart.
You know, I mean, what's going to come after this? It's like, this is just nuts.
We had a bit of swagger by the time we got to All of My Heart because it was written in the studio and it started off as a country and western sort of... Because with Trevor Horn, I realised he had quite a short attention span and still has. He's great.
Wow.
So if he didn't like anything, he'd throw his pencil down on the floor and he knew you'd lost his attention. You have to suss things out pretty quickly when you're in the recording studio. So I'd say, no, we've got this other idea. And we spoofed up a kind of country and western. Once upon a time when we were friends, I gave you my heart, the story. And we had this kind of country and western vamp, and then we kind of played it straight, and it sounded a bit more like ABC, and it developed from there. And
wow.
Trevor said he'd give me £1 million if it got to number one, and he gave me an IOU, but only if we put strings on it. And I said to him, a full orchestra on it. We'd had some pizzicatos and stuff.
Yeah.
And bits and pieces before. He said, no, we'll have a full orchestra on it. And I said, well, do you mean like She's Gone by Hall & Oates, which I love? Or he said, well, Bridge Over Troubled Water, there's an orchestra. And I was going, is there? I don't know, you know.
Wow.
There is, but you don't, you know, it's not in your face. And he was trying to say that it would be a monumental sound, not bland or showbiz, but it would enhance it and take it further. So that was a great suggestion, yeah.
Yeah.
The single came out and got to number four, I think, so I never cashed the IOU.
No.
Technically, I could go to him now with the IOU and say, the album got to number one.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's fair. So, yeah, and I don't know if this is true, but on the recording of that, everything fell into place immediately, very quickly. So that really happens. You know, Tuesday, put down the track. Tuesday evening, record the vocal. Wednesday, record the strings.
Yeah.
Thursday, start mixing it.
Would you say it's the most romantic song on the album?
I think so. It's a song, you know, in 2024, when I stand on stage and I sing it at festivals or with the orchestra, with the band in it, you know, if you're playing a club in California or somewhere, it always has the same response. Sometimes people wipe away a tear. The beautiful thing about being in a band and a singer, I'm the singer, not the song. It's like kind of the songs are bigger than any of us.
Yeah.
And if you've got a song that can just lift people's hearts, you know,
even
all these years on. For me, people talk about nostalgia, but when you play live, you're only in the moment. You've nowhere to hide, have you, Tim? You know, you're just there and then. That's what it's about. So All of My Heart is a great song. I'm indebted to it because it's one of those songs that I can play in any way, shape or form, you know, on a piano, guitar, a cappella. People always respond to it emotionally, so I'm pleased that that one came through.
Yeah.
Anyways.
It's the one that resonates the most
with me. But not all songs are like that, of course.
No, of course not.
There's 200 other songs that aren't.
Okay, time to hear that track we've been talking about. The eighth one on the album, The Lexicon of Love, All My Heart, on Absolute Radio. That's All My Heart from ABC. We're doing a listening party for their debut album. And the next song is called Forever Together. And this would be the most epic, I suppose. Is that the reason why it's, you know, close to the end, or
I think
was
it was
built like that?
I think it was recorded last, so we were off the leash, really.
Yeah.
There was a grab bag of stuff I'd not used, so lyrically, there were bits I could throw in. And also, we had this sample of Speak No Evil, like a really low evil sound on a Fairlight. So that kind of entertained us. We knew we had to put that on a record.
Yeah.
We were just experimenting with samples.
I'm still quite obsessed with the Fairlight because it was before my time. So
and it was Fairlight 1, and then a Fairlight 2 had code, so you could actually sequence it.
So this is like, you know, pre-Pro Tools, really, is it?
Yeah.
Well, it is pre-Pro Tools, but it did a similar but more primitive job.
Yeah, the 2, it had its own Fairlight code, but it was kind of a bit like flying a World War 1 plane because you never knew if it was going to be in time or it would stray.
But it was the most expensive piece of equipment at the time,
right? There was a Synclavier, I believe.
Yeah.
There was word that a Synclavier was like a Bentley or something.
Okay.
But Trevor had got the Fairlight 1 and he got JJ Jezelcik, who was in Art of Noise later, to kind of go down to the Thames and just record ambient river stuff and come back to the studio. You know, it was kind of cool. There was lots of things.
And lots of, like, The Dreaming and Hounds of Love was recorded on that. And Peter Gabriel's stuff as well, right?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. I think Peter Gabriel was involved with Psycho Acoustics, who made Fairlights, back in the day.
Wow.
Then there was the Fairlight 2. So, by today's standards, any phone would be more sophisticated than that. But it was an incredible machine. It was the first time pre-sampling machines, pre-sampling synths. It was kind of there it was, the Fairlight. So that's why we were in love with it.
That's amazing. So this track now, Forever Together, I mean, were you sort of reaching for such epic heights? Because I'm kind of like very interested in how the closer becomes the closer, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? The last track on an album is really important, I think.
Yeah.
It's the kind of swan song, even though we change the order when we play it now.
Because you never know whether you're going to make another album for a start.
No.
And you want people to go away with the thought that you want to give them, you know, the final thought.
Well, you want them to flip it over and start again.
That would be great.
When people listen to music that way, I don't know if they do now.
To go back to the start. But, you know, but you want to leave them with a good taste, you know. And
Forever Together, it was all 4-2, 4-2, 4-2. Forever Together for years to come, for love too strong for us to part.
Yeah.
For when two hearts beat strong and sweet. And it was kind of pre-Prince, you know. Prince would always have 4 and 2, you know.
Yeah.
Somebody said that he nicked it from us, but I don't know. I love Prince so much.
Of course he did.
I don't know about the idea of him being influenced by anyone, apart from James Brown and Sly Stone. But the lyric came from, I lived on Hyde Park Flats, and I went into the lift, and it was a big metal lift that would go up to these flats. And on the wall, somebody had written, forever together, 4 years to come, for love too strong. And I kind of thought to myself, what a romantic kind of idea in such an unromantic place.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's kind of like the lifts that took you up to 99 Roland Row is where I lived on Hyde Park Flats after I was at university there. So I kind of nicked it. I don't even think I took a picture of it. I wrote it down and it came to the fore later. So I'm indebted to whoever did that bit of graffiti.
Yeah.
But that's the chorus in Forever Together. For years to come,
setting. It's a remarkable song.
So that's probably the most prog track.
Yeah, I mean, we
were gone.
It's really far-reaching.
But that, there we were. We sailed off into the sunset.
Well, let's hear it. This is Forever Together.
Close my eyes, you know. Love goes
Martin, we've come to the end of the album.
The album finishes with a version of Look of Love Part 4, which is how we finish the stage show today with our swan song, and we wave as we head off into the horizon, into the sunset.
Perfect, right?
Yeah.
Could you have made a better first album?
Well, the funny thing is, at the time I said to Trevor, I think we need more songs, you know.
Wow.
There's a sense, you have no idea when you're making something, realistically.
No.
I'm talking in hindsight here, all these years on. And I have to say, it was great to have so much talent in the room, from, you know, Steve Singleton and Dave Palmer and Mark White in the band, and Brad Lang and Gary and Dudley, Trevor. It was a great collaboration.
An impressive
Trevor had a lot to prove. It was the first thing he was producing outside of his own work, and he did it brilliantly. And I mean, he's a world-class producer. It speaks,
of course,
volumes. You don't need me to say that. But it was a great moment in time. And for me, that's what making music's all about, really. Getting around a group of people together and capturing the moment, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's a funny thing. You can't even describe it, really, you know. But it happened in Psalm East back then.
Yeah, because you weren't envisaging building a team, were you?
No. No, and you don't think, oh, 40 years later, people are going to want to hear the record or stuff. But we had a cassette of a Poison Arrow on the first sessions, and we had a van, and it broke down in Chesterfield. And I remember you'd take a cassette of a monitor mix and play it over and over again. And we waited at the side of the road. We used to play that, and it started snowing, and the band were just at the side of the road waiting for the guy to come and fix the van. And we must have played that backing track over about, I don't know, 10, 12 times more. And it just sounded fantastic. And for me, I think I knew then we would stumbled across something, you know. Yeah. It was just pleasurable listening to it yourself.
Wow.
But back then, no. You know, the crazy thing about music business is as soon as you do something, you've got to do something else.
Yeah.
So, you have no time to take a breath. Maybe that's what I'm doing today.
Well, it's amazing talking to you.
Thanks very much.
What an album. And Martin Fry, thank you very much.
Thank you. Cheers, Tim.
That's The Look of Love, part four, concluding the listening part in Absolute Radio. Thank you to Martin Fry for taking me through ABC's The Lexicon of Love. Now, it's the point where I like to suggest a few records that I've been listening to this past week. So what I'm going to recommend is MGMT. I mean, I'm a fan, but I really love this new album. It's called Loss of Life. And the track I can't stop listening to, really, is Mother Nature. So Air are coming back with dates, and I think it's a 26-year anniversary of Moon Safari, which is a fantastic album. So I'm going to just choose something from that. Remember, I've been listening to that song a lot recently anyway. The next track I'm going to recommend, Broadcast, Before We Begin, taken from the album Ha Ha Sound. Broadcast, just fantastic band. I was going to say Birmingham band, really, but, you know, it doesn't matter where they're from. It sounds like, you know, it came from another world, really. And another recommendation is a band I've loved for a long time. I've probably recommended something by them on this show before. It's Lamb Chop, and their album Thriller. I think it's kind of a mini album, really, maybe 7 or 8 tracks. But the song that I somehow recently I've just been putting on repeat, even though I've known the album for years, is Hey, Where's Your Girl? I urge you to replay any of the past episodes of my listening party by searching and following Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts. There you'll be able to catch up on every episode of the series, from Texas, The Bangles, The Kinks, Sparks, The, and you too. There's so much there to listen to, so check it out. As always, keep tweeting me through your thoughts using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party. Every song in this episode of my listening party was taken from ABC's The Lexicon of Love. The album was released on Neutron in June 82. I'm Tim Burgess, and thanks for listening. I'll see you soon for another listening party.
Absolute Radio, telling the story behind another iconic album with Tim Burgess.
Get involved using the hashtag Tim's Twitter Listening Party.